is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Ukraine crisis. And we begin with the headlines from Europe that are both promising and deviling. The Bloomberg. Kyiv said peace talks will resume tomorrow online. The aim for the next week, says the release, is to agree enough to set up a meeting between Presidents Putin and Zelensky. Ukraine said Russia will open a humanitarian corridor to evacuate people from Mariupol. The United Kingdom said strikes remain significant around Chernihiv, despite Russian statements that it intends to reduce activity in that area. Anatole, it is very much the fog of war, but I'm going to hold on to the reference to peace talks. What we have from Istanbul in these last days is 2 days of conversations that it's fog of diplomacy following a fog of war. But to generalize the reporting from all ranges, generally following Minsk II, the conversation in 2015, what you have outlined for many weeks, and in fact for a year, is a remedy to the present conflict that is now damaging all economies and all households across Europe and around the globe. So let us review Minsk II. What you see now in the reporting about these conversations that's different than Minsk II, what is imaginable after all this violence? Good day to you, Anatole.
Hello, John. Well, I mean, one very positive and very sensible, I have to say, and wise offer from the Ukrainian side has been, while, of course, continuing to insist in principle on Ukrainian sovereignty over Crimea and the Donbass, to say that these issues should be subject to separate, you know, ongoing negotiations, and that in the meantime, neither side should try to change the status of these areas by force. They've also even offered to end the water blockade of Crimea. Now, This is extremely sensible because, of course, there was no way that the Ukrainians were going to be able to drive Russia out of Crimea or the parts of the Donbass that they occupied before the war. And what this opens is the possibility, frankly, of a process like that in Cyprus, you know, where for 45 years there have been negotiations about the reunification of Cyprus between northern Turkish Cyprus after the Turkish invasion of 1975 and the Republic of Cyprus. They've never led anywhere, but equally, the dispute did not prevent southern Cyprus from joining the European Union. And above all, of course, there has been no resumption of war. So this is a very positive move, but there's one colossal problem, which is that before the war, the Russian-backed separatist republics of the Donbass only occupied part of the territory of the Donbass, and they did not hold Mariupol, which is a city of the Donbass. Now, of course, Russia is trying to expand its control to conquer the whole territory of the Donbass. Now, the Ukrainians are willing to kick the issue of the separatist areas before the war into, you know, diplomatic timeout. But I don't see how they can agree to allow new areas to be included. So this, I think, is probably the biggest single obstacle now to peace.
The breakup of the Soviet Union left us with a map across all of Eurasia that is particularly important here because of the construction of exclaves, something here in North America we're unfamiliar with. To my knowledge, we don't have one about American territory, the islands notwithstanding, because they are separated by water from the mainland. However, exclaves are commonplace across Central Asia. I know because I've spent time in Uzbekistan and talked to Kazakhstan. There are a number of exclaves that create tensions, but at the same time appear to be relatively stable. Is the construction of exclaves or parts of Ukraine that are neither this nor that, is that something that's imaginable for peace for all of Ukraine and for southern Russia?
Yes, I think it's certainly imaginable. That's one possible solution. Another solution is to have a referendum in the Donbass. That would meet, by the way, a Russian and separatist demand to have a referendum in the whole of the Donbass, but on a district-by-district basis. In other words, not that the whole province of Donetsk and the whole province of Lugansk should decide, but that each district should decide where to go. That could lead to exclaves, or it could actually lead simply to the prior division, you know, up to the Russian invasion. Because, you know, the separatist areas have been bombarded pretty heavily by the Ukrainians for the past 8 years. From what one gathers, that has not left them with great affection for Ukraine. On the other hand, I would very much doubt that many people in, you know, in Mariupol have much sympathy for Russia left, given what has happened. And so that would be a democratic way out of this. It would not, of course, satisfy either side. Neither side would get everything it wanted. But then, you know, no peace settlement is going to satisfy either side. And it might just be enough to allow both sides to claim success. Because as a leading peace negotiator with whom I talked yesterday said, you know, key to so many peace settlements of this kind is to allow both sides to think that they've won. And certainly Putin is now, you know, given that things have gone so badly for the Russian invasion, I think Putin is quite desperate to get something out of this that can look like a success that he can present to the Russian people.
You remind me, because I'm reading the biography of George III, Andrew Roberts, at the same time, which is supposed to be long ago and far away, the 18th century, and how the Seven Years' War was concluded in 1763 to the satisfaction of no one. But at the same time, that was how European wars started and stopped across the continent in the 18th, even 19th century. I'm puzzling here because your vision of a resolution here reminds me that this is something Europe is accustomed to. We're not in North America, as you understand, Anatole. We use firepower and maximum force to win everything, or we don't call it resolved. That is the history, the very short history of the United States, which comes out of that European conflict theory of you fight and fight and fight, and then you resolve until the next time you fight and fight and fight. Is that something that is familiar to the European capitals that will be critical here? Because Europe is paying for this right now in inflation, energy prices, and instability in its democratic process. Is Europe ready to accept something that does not resolve anything, but looks like a seven-year, looks like the Treaty of Paris, 1763, that made everybody unhappy?
I think most of Europe is. Of course, you know, Europeans are divided. The Poles would not be willing to. The Germans probably would. But of course, the problem is that this may also require the West to offer the lifting of at least some of the sanctions against Russia. Sanctions which, by the way, are also doing immense damage to the world economy in general. Now, at that point, it may require the Europeans also to have a confrontation with Washington, because, of course, there are powerful forces in Washington which want to keep the sanctions up until the Putin regime can be overthrown. And frankly, whether the Europeans have it in them to confront America in this way, I rather doubt. I mean, the history of recent months has been that the Europeans have basically abdicated security responsibility for their own continent.
And Moscow's point of view, because you are very familiar with the Russian management of conflict, zones. We've had many examples of it since the end of the Soviet Union and then prior to that. Is Moscow the Moscow thinking, is it agreeable to a resolution that satisfies no one but does end the fighting?
Well, you know, something very interesting and bitterly ironic, but also amusing if your sense of humor runs in that direction, has started happening in recent days. Ever since the Russian government has started talking about a compromise with Ukraine, you know, giving up demilitarization, giving up denazification, you know, agreeing to negotiate on the sovereignty of Crimea, you've had actually quite a lot of Russian ultra-nationalists on the social media, even a bit on television, which is, of course, very strictly state-controlled, who are now attacking Putin for cowardice and weakness and giving in. Now, of course, you can very well blame him for that. He's hoist with his own petard, as the old saying has it, because he built up these people. But, I mean, that does indicate, you know, once again, that Putin is now vulnerable. You know, he is responsible for this war, and this war, you know, whatever the Russian government may claim, has most certainly not gone to plan. And, of course, thousands of Russian troops, you know, have been killed. So I think the Putin regime is now in some difficulty there, and as I say, is desperate for anything that it can present, you know, as some kind of victory.
You, in remarks these last days, have made reference to an Afghanistan solution for Ukraine. Is that still imaginable? Because it sounds the worst case scenario, to beggar a whole country and to abandon it to its deserts.
Well, I mean, I was around at the moment, but I must say also yesterday, when I heard that the British Deputy Prime Minister, on behalf of the British government, has said that no, as part of a treaty of neutrality, Britain will not give any security guarantees to Ukraine because Ukraine is not a member of NATO and we're not going to guarantee Ukrainian security. Now, after all these promises, these bloviating statements about solidarity and firmness and toughness, you know, I mean, what a filthy joke that is. Yes, I mean, there are risks that that key elements in the West will in fact block a peace settlement because they're not willing to guarantee Ukraine security on the one hand, and on the other hand, there are people who, as you say, want to use Ukraine, like Afghanistan, to bleed Russia and hopefully eventually to bring down the Putin regime, you know, possibly to weaken and even destroy Russia, to isolate China. And just as they did not give a damn how many Afghans died, you know, in pursuit of this agenda in Afghanistan in the 1980s, so I don't think that these people give a damn how many Ukrainians die in the service of America's geopolitical ambitions.
I'm speaking to Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Right now, it's fog of war, fog of diplomacy. The fighting and the dying go on in Ukraine. At the same time, the peace talks are promised to continue online, looking to a face-to-face meeting between the two presidents. At the same time, there's a presidential contest in France. All of the leadership of Europe is in motion because of energy prices. The question is asked in the New York Times by Brett Stevens in these last hours. Is this an energy war? Is Ukraine's struggles part of the larger story of energy in the 21st century? When we come back, what about the European capitals watching this peace talk? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.